Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan. I'm an editor at Aval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today from Berlin is my guest, Yektan Türkyılmaz, who is a research fellow at the Forum for Transregional Studies in Berlin. Yektan, pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Yektan, the first question I really wanted to ask you is your view on some of the politics going on in Turkey right now, especially after, you know, a series of major events that have been happening, the peace in Nagorno-Karabakh, we had the U.S. election, of course, and then last week, Erdogan sacking much of the economic team, and then the resignation of his son-in-law and finance minister, Berat Albayrak. How do you interpret this situation? Because, you know, the Turkish media at the time, they had a bit of a blackout when it came to covering at least Albayrak's resignation. And then some of the opposition parties were writing it off as palace intrigue that's just harmful for the country. What is your view of it?
So obviously, so many things happening in the country over the, like, you know, past 4 or 5 years is bad for the country. Let me start saying that. But if you specifically ask about the most recent, let's say, crisis, I think this is a clear sign that we are in the process of this regime crumbling. And it's literally crumbling. You see pieces and some important figures falling apart. And the extent of this crisis, we still do not know. Because there is still much silence around the issue, but leaving aside the parts of the story that we still do not know, and we will probably not know until some other crisis break out or some other piece or part crumbles from the regime block. But obviously, this resignation or there's a palace intrigue, as you framed it, will have far-fetching consequences for the Erdogan regime and for the country altogether. And we will see the implications. I think we will not need to wait years to see the implications. My opinion is that Turkish regime is in the process of crumbling. And as you mentioned, the elections in the United States, the economic situation in the country, the crisis is not only about the economy, by the way. That is the most, perhaps, like, you know, we talk about that a lot, but, you know, maybe because that is many pundits or observers think that that is what is going to trigger the collapse of the regime in Turkey. But if you look at, like, you know, other sectors of the society, let's say look at education, look at, like, you know, how the regime is trying to or not trying to deal with COVID situation, you see, I mean, that you see a country which is in crisis in all walks of the life. So I would be an exaggeration to say that, like, your Turkey is on the way to a total collapse. It's not economy only, it's not education, it's not the COVID situation, it's not foreign policy only. We are talking about a crisis in all sectors, in all walks of the society and in the country, but the most visible currently is the economic crisis.
Yeah. So, you know, speaking of kind of like Turkey's foreign affairs for a second, you know, in the news recently, earlier this month, we received reports that France had moved to ban a Turkish ultranationalist organization called the Grey Wolves. And the Grey Wolves are not a new name to introduce into the lexicon. It's been around for something like 50 years by now, and it's known to have close connections to, you know, Erdogan's coalition partner, Devlet Bahçeli, and his MHP party. So just for the listeners, would you be able to tell us about, like, who are the Grey Wolves and how does the organization or movement differ from yesterday to today?
Sure. I mean, we to understand the movement, I mean, first of all, gray mobs is not the name or the institutional name for the group. Actually, in Turkey, we need to go back to late 1960s, early 70s to understand the origins of the group. The Ülke Ocakları has been a kind of the youth organization of MHP, Milliyetçi Hareket Partisi, Nationalist Movement Party, and between especially between 1970 and 1980, the that group has been accused for quite a lot of criminal activities, including hundreds of murders of the leftists, especially. And regarding the European part, this group, you know, any group you have in Turkey would have, like, you know, also reflections in Europe, because, you know, Turkey is a very big immigrant community living in Europe, in different countries of Europe. So there's been activities of this group since 1970s. By the way, we have to also, like, you know, I need to note here that, like, in this group also, like, some members of group of this group also has also historically been closely linked to Turkish intelligence. That's no secret to anybody. So, but recently, things about this group has changed a lot. First of all, when you said, Greg said, for example, when we, if we were to be, like, in talking about gray wolves, let's say 20 years ago, then we would be talking only about MHP and the gray wolves, right? So then you would talk about this party, political party, and its youth, or its we could locate gray wolves as the side organization of that party. But things has changed a lot, especially over the 5-6 years, in the sense that currently it is really difficult to distinguish between where the gray wolves end, where the AKP organization, youth organization, or AKP's Europe organization start, and where that ends, and where, like, for example, the diplomatic organization, diplomatic institutions of the country starts, and where that ends, and this DTIP thing starts. So the right now, we are now talking about, like, you know, this has become a reality, especially particularly, like, you know, over the past 4-5 years, that is, we see an amalgamation of various groups, political groups, plus the DTIP organization, that is the Diyanet, which is the Supreme Council of Religious Affairs in Turkey, and they run many mosques in Europe, in France, in Germany, and elsewhere, and Turkey's diplomatic mission, DTIP, intelligence, gray wolves, and AKP's various organizations. I mean, this, they have, you see the process, we witness the process of amalgamation and also a coordination. So let me give you this example. It's not new that Turkey state is fighting against its presumed enemies abroad. But how it used to work, well, would be, they would probably send some people, not necessarily directly members of Turkish intelligence, but linked to the intelligence, and they will have those people get the job done, and return. And we have, for example, we know the case of Alaaddin Çakıcı, Abdullah Çatlı, who were sent to Europe to attack Armenian targets. Targets, Armenian targets affiliated with the Asala. But now it's a totally different situation. I don't know if you recall this arrest made by Austrian security forces.
Yes, that was fairly recently, within the last few months.
Yes, I think that if I'm not wrong, it was Feyyaz Öztürk, right?
Yes.
And she was raised. She was born. She was raised. He was born. He was raised in Europe. He's European. You know, he's Europe grown. So what I'm trying to say is, there is. Actually, in terms of fighting against our enemies, the idea didn't change. But how that is being done has radically, dramatically changed over the past 4 or 5 years, in the sense that you see an effort to mobilize, or it would be a better term to say weaponize, the presence or Erdogan or pro MHP presence. I mean, there's an effort to weaponize this, not only against the enemies. By the way, when we talk about enemies, again, there's also a shift in the definition of enemies, because Turkey had its, let's say, conventional enemies or traditional enemies, like which we could have summarized with 3 Ks: Kurd, Kızılbaş, communist, right? Mm-hmm. But now there's also the Gülenists. So it's now a broader spectrum of Turkish society who are being described or defined as enemies. But there's also another objective here, goal here. They want this influence also help Turkish authorities achieve certain goals in the politics of those countries. Let's note that two parties were formed, one in Denk in the Netherlands, the other one in alliance of German Democrats in Germany.
There's also a party that was associated with them in France as well.
Yeah. Yes. So, these are most widely known ones, but the thing is you see an effort not only to weaponize the influence here against the enemies, but also an effort to achieve certain goals or to intervene in the politics of those countries. I think when we look at this, the move in, or let's say the Macron's or France banning or efforts to ban gray wolves, or Germany, again, the same thing. By the way, there is, this is not, these are not partisan moves, by the way, because there is much support in those countries, both from opposition and the governments to that effect, because, I think the European governments are becoming more and more concerned and irritated by Turkey's efforts to intervene in their politics. I think one can add to this these steps, the German security forces storming into a mosque here, which is a DTIP mosque, a couple of weeks ago, Mevlana Mosque in Berlin. The message here is very clear. And gray wolves are not the extreme Turkish nationalists anymore. Gray wolves is a circle, is a political group, is an organization that is affiliated with the partner of the current Turkish government. Mm. So, I mean, we should get the symbolism here. So it's basically both in Germany and France, what you see here is an attempt to ban the activities of a group which is organically linked to the current Turkish government. I think this is a very strong message.
You know, Yektan, you already answered part of my next question actually before through this answer. But I want to ask you, it's because, you know, we've seen reports, at least from German intelligence and other European intelligence agencies, such as in Austria and the Netherlands, that have highlighted, you know, some of these Turkish nationalist groups as a concern for some time. And of course, there's a lot of that concern relating to other activities, whether it's the Diyanet mosques operating across Europe. And it seems like now, though, they're choosing to act against this extended long arms of the, say, Turkish state right now. And, you know, President Macron, right before and then after the execution of Samuel Paty by an ISIS extremist, he spoke about wanting to specifically target the Turkish exporting of Islam through, you know, foreign trained imams there, and so on. But why do you think that it took them so long to really decide that this is the moment to really act against these subversive, by their definition, activities from these Turkish groups that are connected in some way to the Turkish state, like in France's case, they use the Grey Wolves.
I think it's not that, as you said, it's not that European governments didn't know about these activities. They were aware. You know, if you look at the reports by the Federal Office for the Protection of Constitution in Germany, it's so clearly stated. And there have been so many cases over the past couple of years in Germany about infiltration of Turkish agents to the police force, even to intelligence. So, but the thing is, I think it's not that, like, you know, that these European governments did not know about that, but I think any step is costly regarding any step against Turkey is costly. They're also aware about the costs. And there is this, the Syrian refugees issue. There are also concerns about not letting Turkey totally go out of the orbit, Western orbit. That's one thing. But there is also some, you know, very important economic relations between Germany and Turkey, between France and Turkey, between the Netherlands and Turkey. So it's been a costly thing. I mean, I think they deemed it very costly to take action. But I think there is now the realization that it might be even costlier not to do anything, because the situation is aggravating around Turkey, and Turkish politics is getting more and more radicalized or more and more aggressive, not only in Turkey, but also abroad. And I think one crucial move here was this Mavi Vatan thing, this new doctrinal thing, I think that is a very important shift in Turkish politics, because when if you look at the framework of that Mavi Vatan, the so-called Mavi Vatan doctrine, you know, who would be your enemies there if you're trying to? That's West. That is West. That is NATO member or EU member countries. Those are the countries that you see as your rivals. So it shows the new direction of Turkish politics under this government. So I think one can add some other reasons, but I think first and foremost, it is the realization that not intervening, not taking steps, any steps, might be even more costlier, might be more costly to European governments. And also, I think one thing we need to add, you know, to this entire issue about Turkey's activities within migrant communities in Europe is that, you know, this has a history. And which goes back to 1990s. One might even take it back to 1980s. But I say 1990s because as of 1990s, I think that you see this intent, this will among certain political groups, or even among certain governmental circles, to increase its soft power among the immigrants. First, Turkish immigrants, immigrants from Turkey. Let's not call them Turkish immigrants because not all of them are Turks, of course. Among immigrants from Turkey, and perhaps also Muslim immigrants from elsewhere. So, and I think, I mean, a great example is, I think, Milli Görüş there. I mean, there, if you look at, like, you know, Milli Görüş, it's basically, it's a European organization. Its major allegiance is to if you look at, like, you know, if you're talking about Milli Görüş in Germany, to Germany. And it talks to the public with the terms, idioms of German politics, right? And actually, I think Gulenis and the network that Gulenis created further made this creating a global soft power very, let's say, attractive to Turkish governments. But I think after the coup, the attempt coup, the failed coup, what you see is the government taking over all these networks and trying to use that soft power network. But what happens is the way they reorganize, they reshape these networks, took away whatever is soft about them. So now we are left with just simple hard power. You see the groups which obviously have links to the embassy, to the Turkish state, and attacking demonstrators in an organized manner in Austria. And then you see this case in which there is an assassination attempt. And then you see these statements by Turkish officials basically kind of showing the stick to Europeans that, like, you know, you won't be safe. So what we have gradually witnessed since the failed coup in Turkey is that the collapse of that soft power strategy and that turning into all hard power and to a state-sponsored activity altogether, and then losing all its persuasion power over the host populations or over the host countries.
You know, I have another question that I put forward to another one of my guests before, Marwa Maziad over at the Middle East Institute after France announced new measures following Samuel Paty's murder. And it comes down to this, you know, this narrative of the civilizational conflict. And there are some that see even European moves, such as those being suggested by France in particular, as just contributing to a sense of, like, wider social alienation of these communities in Europe. So, and they also talk about the role that this brand of political Islam that is being exported by countries such as Turkey is playing in creating this as President Macron put it, this counter society within the European states. So what I want to ask you is that do you think that there's some credence to this idea that they could push too far and radicalize potentially more people, or do you think that there's ample reason for Europe to really begin questioning the part played in by these say entities, whether it's the Turkish one such as the Dayanet or Grey Wolf associated organizations? Do you think that there's good reason for Europe to really be asking these questions now, like what the role these organizations have in affecting their domestic political life or social life?
Yeah, thank you very much. This is a great question. And it's a very broad question, by the way. But let me start saying that, obviously this is not a war of civilization thing. I mean, that's
Erdogan's narrative, essentially.
Yeah. And also, I think European right-wing, political circles share the same narrative, by and large. This, and on the one hand side, I agree that there is crisis around Islam. This is not the crisis of Quran, Hadith, or things like that. I'm talking about politics done with reference to Islam and how they mobilize groups, their brave programs. And there is a problem in politics of Islam. And that is, I think that I agree with that. Or, I don't know how, maybe not 100% with Macron, but I think by and large, I agree with them. But the issue with the immigrants is not an Islamic issue. That's a European issue. That's about the way European states, governments approach today's society. I think, yes, one good step is, of course, no state would like to allow some external forces or states manipulate the existing problem. But obviously, European governments need to rethink their entire approach to these groups. I can give you many examples, but just one example is that actually for a long time, if you look at German so-called the adaptation thing, that how to adopt this, it's kind of, I see that as a step that paved the way to today. So I think the crisis is more the European understanding of those communities, Islam, and their own society than being about those groups. And that, the issue, the existing, are the, would it be, can we say that existing problems are being manipulated? Yes, by Turkish government, by Erdogan. Yes, and in that sense, one can understand why there is increasing concern, in Europe, in Austria, in France, in the Netherlands, in Germany, about activities not only of Grey Wolves. That would be misleading. I think that's the symbolic message, but about DTIP, but about the activities of consulates, but about certain mosques and their connections abroad. Oftentimes it goes unnoticed, but if you go back to the 4-point program that Macron introduced, one of them was banning the imams. Foreign imams. That might be a starting point, but that will not bring the solution. The solution needs to be sought for within the European governing mentality and seeded this as a European problem. And the way they solve it will tell us what kind of a Europe they want to see. So that's the decision, I think, that these governments are at the brink of making right now.
And it does seem that some of the measures that are being proposed afterwards are kind of reiterations of some of the old solutions to what they saw as, you know, a problem of radicalization or terrorism, where they Macron talked more about strengthening Europe's borders to protect against radical elements entering the country. And then, of course, you have these more, like, delegating more powers to law enforcement and intelligence agencies to essentially solve a problem that may be beyond their remit. But do you think that Turkey plays a part in just really fanning so much of the flames through the rhetoric they give about Europe? When they make these moves, they're behaving Islamophobically, or do you think that the European governments themselves are just still kind of struggling to really think what is the most sustainable solution to this, and these are just the easier options to go with right now?
Is there Islamophobia in Europe? Yes, for sure. But I think as much as we have Islamophobia, perhaps more, we have manipulation of them. So we need to talk about the boat. And can we find imprints of Islamophobia in these, let's say, precautions or, let's say, new policies? Perhaps. Why not? I mean, we know that, like, you know, again, like, you know, we have very wide segments of various European countries which are quite Islamophobic or xenophobic, let's say. I mean, not only Islamophobic, this is also, like, you know, we need to place this within in the broader anti-immigrant let's say discourse. I don't think that. I mean, this, you know, there is serious and real concern in Europe. I mean, like, look what happened in Vienna recently. Look what happened. I mean, there is serious concern. This cannot be just relegated to Islamophobia. I will go back to my previous response, saying that, like, you know, it's European leaders are not deciding only about, like, you know, what to do about their, let's say, about their, some of them citizens, some of them residents, some of them just maybe illegal. They're not only deciding about these Muslim groups in their countries, but they're deciding about themselves, what kind of a Europe they want to see. And I hope that, like, you know, this will lead to a broader, deeper discussion within Europe and change its state-centered approach or holistic approach to these communities and how to solve the issues. And one thing for sure, of course, they will take, like, you know, security precautions or measures, but this issue cannot be just demoted, like, you know, or can be seen or treated as a security issue. It's not. And that is, again, going to be a very serious decision that will shape future Europe.
Yektan, it was a pleasure to have this conversation with you. And thank you. I really do hope that you can join me again sometime on Turkey Abroad. So
looking forward to that.
Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.